Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, October 15th, 2005. Today, we will take a deeper look at some Middle East happenings and issues. We start with an interview by Tom Jackson of Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission and host of Uprising, a daily news program on Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles. We'll also have commentary by Steve Diamond and music to finish up our first hour. We'll hear a report from the Music and Censorship Conference happening in Beirut, and Between the Lines, independent radio from Connecticut. We'll also bring you some people's history, a poem, and more. First, for some news. This one is from the Associated Press. Bush teleconference with soldiers staged. It was billed as a conversation with U.S. troops, but the questions President Bush asked on a teleconference call Thursday were choreographed to match his goals for the war in Iraq and Saturday's vote on a new Iraqi constitution. Allison Barber, Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary, said, "This is an important time," coaching the soldiers before Bush arrived. Barber said the president was interested in three topics: the overall security situation in Iraq, security preparations for the weekend vote, and efforts to train Iraqi troops. As she spoke in Washington, a live shot of 10 soldiers from the Army's 42nd Infantry Division and one Iraqi soldier was beamed into the Eisenhower Executive Office Building from Tikrit. Barber said, "I'm going to ask somebody to grab those two water bottles against the wall and move them out of the camera shot for me." A brief rehearsal ensued. Before he took questions, Bush thanked the soldiers for serving and reassured them that the U.S. would not pull out of Iraq until the mission was complete. "So long as I'm the president, we're never going to back down, we're never going to give in, we'll never accept anything less than total victory," Bush said. The president told them twice that the American people were behind them. "You've got tremendous support here at home," Bush said. Less than 40% in an AP Ipsos poll taken in October said they approved of the way Bush was handling Iraq. Just over half of the public now say the Iraq war was a mistake. The soldiers all gave Bush an upbeat view of the situation. Paul Rykoff, director of the New York-based Operation Truth, an advocacy group for U.S. veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, denounced the event as a carefully scripted publicity stunt. From the Financial Times, FT.com. Conservatives and exiles desert war campaign. Expressions of concern among conservatives and former Iraqi exiles, seen also in the rising disillusionment of the American public, reflect a widening gap with the Bush administration and its claims of incredible political progress in Iraq. Over the past week, two of Washington's most influential conservative think tanks, the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, and the Heritage Foundation, held conferences on Iraq where the mood among speakers, including Iraqi officials, was decidedly somber. Kanan Makiya, an outspoken proponent of the war who is documenting the horrors of the Saddam regime in his Iraq Memory Foundation, opened the AEI meeting by admitting to many dashed dreams. He said he and other opposition figures had seriously underestimated the powers of ethnic and sectarian self-interest, as well as the survivability of the constantly morphing and flexible Ba'ath Party. He also blamed the Bush administration for poor planning and committing too few troops. The proposed constitution, to be taken to a referendum on Saturday, was a profoundly destabilizing document that could deal a death blow to Iraq, he said. The Constitution was a recipe for greater chaos, said Rend Rahim, a former exile who had been designated as Iraq's first post-war ambassador to the U.S. Unless revised, it would lead to such a devolution of power that the central government would barely exist, she said. From the Associated Press. Ex-Marine says he committed atrocities. A former U.S. Marine in Iraq alleges that his battalion committed atrocities against Iraqi civilians during the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, including shooting unarmed protesters. Jimmy Massey, a staff sergeant who was in the Marines for 12 years and served 3 months in Iraq before being honorably discharged with post-traumatic stress syndrome, details the allegations in his book called Kill, 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 written with a French journalist, Natasha Saulnier, and published in France. A Pentagon spokeswoman said Massey's complaints had already been investigated and found to be unsubstantiated. Massey said he was in charge of a platoon in the 3rd Battalion of Regimental Combat Team 7, responsible for setting up checkpoints and providing armed cover against terrorists and insurgents. He alleges that over a period of a month and a half in 2003, his platoon killed more than 30 civilians in Iraq. Quote, "We, in fact, I feel, escalated the violence," unquote, he told the Associated Press in an interview. Massey said in one case, shortly after April 2003, Marines who heard a gunshot fired upon 10 Iraqi demonstrators shouting anti-U.S. slogans and wielding banners saying, "Go home," near the sprawling al-Rashid military complex southeast of the city center. All but one of the demonstrators were killed, said Massey, who estimated he himself fired about 12 shots. Massey said he later found several rocket-propelled grenades propped on a wall some 500 feet away. He interpreted the demonstrators' failure to use the weapons as a sign of their peaceful intentions. "That day we shot the protesters in the Rashid complex was when I had a moment of clarity, and I understood that by our actions of doing that, we set the tone overall for what the Iraqis were seeing, and the brutality of what we were doing was being displayed," he told the AP. Now here's Tom Jackson talking with Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, a non-profit organization that helps fund the Afghan women's organization, RAWA.
For Making Waves, I'm Tom Jackson. I'm talking with Sonali Kolhatkar, who's the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. It's a U.S.-based nonprofit that works with the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, or RAWA. Sonali, a lot of times in mainstream media, when we hear someone from the Bush administration talking about Afghanistan, things sound very rosy, and there definitely are some steps in positive directions that have happened in Afghanistan. But what were your impressions when you were in Afghanistan earlier this year?
What I found when I went to Afghanistan was that very little had actually changed in practical terms for Afghan people. Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, which is the target of a lot of aid dollars and a lot of media attention, has definitely changed quite dramatically in that people seem freer. There are more women on the streets. Women don't cover themselves like they used to. There is just more activity on the streets. There's a burgeoning media, etc. But Kabul is just a small portion of Afghanistan. The majority of the Afghan people live outside Kabul. They live in the provinces, in villages. And in those parts of Afghanistan, very little has changed. So, for example, from the perspective of an Afghan woman who was told, right, by the Bush administration that she was liberated, before 9/11 and during the Taliban era, she did not have health care, she did not have education, she did not have employment. Her housing may have been very poor. Food was hard to get. After 9/11 and the fall of the Taliban, those things are still true. even though they may be legal now, even though things like employment for women, health care for women, education for women may be legal, in practical terms, very little has actually changed. So that's one of the main things that I found. And it was very, very shocking for me to realize that while things had stayed pretty much the same in Afghanistan, the media coverage had very much dropped. And another thing, of course, I found when I was there was that poverty level was enormous and the cynicism among the Afghan people was growing. So the Afghan people started out being extremely hopeful that the Taliban being gone meant that their country would finally be going in the right direction. They expected the international community to be committed to Afghanistan. They voted for Hamid Karzai in last year's presidential elections. Primarily they voted for him because he promised an end to warlordism. But they found after he was elected that he was simply going to be promoting these warlords into positions of power. He, in fact, promoted several warlords with the most vicious criminal backgrounds into high-level positions in the government. And this has really made a lot of Afghan people much more cynical. And I was definitely surprised by that particular revelation.
And just recently, I've noticed that some of the results of the elections have started to come in. And actually, I would add to that that even in some mainstream reports, I've noticed that they are reporting the fact that there are some warlords who are getting in at some level on the now growing government there. What's your perspective in terms of what you're hearing as far as the election results go?
Well, definitely there's a lot of bad news about the warlords. And I think it has to be really put into perspective that one-third of the population actually voted. You know, one-third of Afghan people voted. About half of them were actually registered to vote. Half of eligible voters were registered to vote. And then of that total, only some percentage actually went out to the polls. Much lower percentage than last year's presidential elections. That indicates that growing cynicism that I was talking about. So you have a minority of the Afghan people who actually bothered voting, and then there was also some fraud that was shown. And you know, one will never know the level of intimidation that went on. Warlords were supposed to not have even been able to run in the election. There was according to the constitution, anybody who has private militias, private armed groups, are ineligible to run in the parliament. And before the election, there was something called the Election Complaints Commission that had drawn up a blacklist of about 200 candidates who, they said, should not be allowed to run. In the end, they only disqualified something like 45 candidates from that list, and most of them are sort of lesser-known candidates. And some of the most major warlords, like Abdul Rasul Sayaf, and others, some of them even former Taliban ministers, actually were allowed to be eligible for the elections. Now, many of these regional commanders and warlords, they're drug lords, they wield a lot of power in their villages and the provinces that they rule over. And if the people of that part of the country know what's good for them, they will vote for this armed man because they know that that if they don't, they're going to get into trouble. So a lot of these warlords were elected, and you know, I say that word elected in quotes, and that's really bad news for the Afghan people. On the other hand, a lot of women were elected because the constitution puts aside a number of seats for women. I think the best news that's come out of the election was the result that Malalai Joya was elected. She is one of the heroes of Afghanistan, really. She gained a lot of fame in early 2004 when she spoke out against the warlords at the Constitutional Convention, the Constitutional Loya Jirga, in 2004 in Kabul, which was supposed to draft and accept the Constitution. She took the microphone and she denounced all of the warlords sitting on the front rows, and she basically said these men ought to be tried for war crimes. Well, she was targeted by the warlords. Her home was ransacked, her office looted. She had to travel with bodyguards. But at the same time, the Afghan people rose up in support of her. She had thousands of messages of solidarity from across Afghanistan. Tribal elders traveled thousands of miles to pay their respects to her. She became the heroine of Afghanistan and essentially was told by the people of Afghanistan, you have spoken for us. You have spoken what we need to hear. and she, I actually met her in Farah province, which is a province she represents, a very, very isolated, small province in western Afghanistan, you know, with no electricity, no running water, no phone service, no internet connections. Farah province, you know, very, very tiny little province, and she was elected by her province when she ran for parliament. She got the second highest number of votes of anybody in Farah province. Over 7,000 people voted for her as a local representative, and so she is in the parliament, and that is perhaps the best news that I've heard from the parliamentary elections.
During the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in fall 2001, Rawa was pretty much in the spotlight in mainstream media. You know, I can remember hearing at least one Rawa rep being interviewed on NPR, and many politicians and celebrities were pointing to Rawa and their incredible bravery, and rightly so. You know, as a group that was standing up to the repression of the Taliban. And yet, once the invasion had happened and the Taliban fell, it seems as though the mainstream attention and the attention of politicians and celebrities has gone away as far as Rawa goes. And yet, the people involved in that organization are still doing great work and still as brave as ever in doing that work. What do you think has happened? I mean, why is it that that the attention level seems to have evaporated as far as the mainstream goes?
Well, the mainstream media never reports on the issues that the U.S. public you know, needs to know. They report on what the administration in power would like for them to report on, and that's generally true with some exceptions. And that was the same with Afghanistan. After 9/11, it became extremely useful and convenient for the Bush administration to have enormous mainstream media coverage of the oppression of Afghan women. And Rawa was given a lot of coverage because Rawa very bravely documented human rights abuses by the Taliban. They were also documenting abuses by the Northern Alliance, but the U.S. didn't want to, the media didn't really cover that part of it because that was inconvenient since the U.S. was backing the Northern Alliance. And it became very trendy for, you know, Hollywood celebs and others to back the issue of Afghan women. Sadly, it also, of course, became a justification for war, which many well-meaning Americans fell for. You know, let's go and wage war to save these women. And the media really didn't cover the issue with enough complexity. They reduced Afghan women to the issue of their garment, the burqa, the forced veiling, which was considered symbolic of their oppression, but really didn't address the complexities of their oppression. So once the laws on forced veiling were repealed, the media considered Afghan women free, which is not, you know, absolutely untrue. And mainstream media has essentially been stenographers for the White House. They have really failed in their duty as journalists. They, you know, they made a big deal about refugees returning to Afghanistan, but they failed to cover what happened to those refugees once they went back in. They failed to cover the fact that these refugees, many of them became internally displaced people with nowhere to go, no employment, no health care, no education. They failed to cover the fact that in practical terms, Afghan women have nothing left. And I think the reason for that is that if Americans were to sort of stop and realize that this country that we supposedly liberated was actually in just as dire need as before, we would really stop and re-examine why we went to war in the first place and whether this so-called war on terrorism is a justifiable war or not. And that's far too dangerous. That's far too subversive. So the mainstream media just doesn't want us to question what happened in Afghanistan. You know, Rawa is on the forefront of providing education in a very political way to both boys and girls. They're in the forefront of women's rights movements in Afghanistan, and their message is extremely dangerous and subversive to both foreign imperialists, like the United States and the Soviet Union that went before them, as well as the fundamentalists from inside, those who are funded by the U.S., as well as the Arab fighters that came to Afghanistan. And if the mainstream media were to do a detailed analysis of what's happened, they would find out that the U.S. has done much more to promote terrorism than to actually work against it. We've worked with elements like the Northern Alliance, who are nothing more than fundamentalist drug lords, who are ideologically extremely similar to the Taliban. And the American people would wonder, why the hell did we work with these folks? You know, what under what justification did we work with these fundamentalist, criminal-minded people who have vicious human rights violations in their past. It's just not convenient. It would raise far too many questions. It is absolutely incumbent on the American people to take a good, hard, long look at Afghanistan, and I would say especially the anti-war movement. I mean, those among your listeners who consider themselves anti-war activists should really ask themselves why they have really ignored Afghanistan. Iraq is extremely important, and I would say that just as much as any anti-war activist, Iraq is extremely important, but Afghanistan is just as important, and we've got to be paying attention to what's happening there, despite the efforts, the best efforts of the mainstream media to hide the truth from us.
Well, I have one sort of devil's advocate question, mainly because I get this kind of question myself fairly often, and I'd be interested to hear what your response to it is. For people who are in favor of what the Bush administration has done post 9/11, one comment that they make frequently is, we brought democracy to these countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. What's your response to that?
My response is that democracy is much more than just elections. You know, here in the United States, we like to reduce the concept of democracy to these events that take place every few years, where people, usually an educated minority, are supposed to come out and vote in favor of the status quo. In Afghanistan, incidentally, when the parliamentary elections took place, and there were such few voters who showed up, one-third of all voters showed up to the polls, and the current U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan was asked to comment on that. You know, his response was that, this is a sign that most countries where people get used to voting, the voter turnout usually drops. This is a sign that Afghanistan's finally becoming a normal country, quote-unquote normal country. So basically, having low participation in elections is equivalent to having a, quote-unquote, normal democratic country. Democracy means much more than elections, and we know that. The fact that over 90% of Afghan women cannot even read and write makes you even stop and think, well, how do they fill out the ballots? You know, they have to rely on these visual aids. The ballots have, like, pictorial representations, images of all these candidates. How are they supposed to run for election if many parts of Afghanistan and the villages still don't allow women to actually bare their face? How are they supposed to run for election? What sort of democracy is this? And I think that has to be really answered. Democracy is about much more than just elections. We have the rudimentary, superficial constructs of democracy, such as elections and voting and voter registration, in place, and that does not mean that you have democracy. Democracy means having an educated population, having a burgeoning media, having the freedom for the population to educate itself about what the issues are, and the freedom to choose the direction of their country. Survey after survey has shown in Afghanistan that the Afghan people are sick and tired of the warlords, and they want an end to warlordism, and they want disarmament, and they want justice for war crimes. There was a survey done by a government agency, the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, called A Call for Justice, which showed that this was true. Well, if Afghanistan was truly a democracy, the warlords would have no power whatsoever because they're extremely unpopular. Democracy is supposed to mean the will of the people goes. Well, the will of the people is being completely subverted in Afghanistan. The will of the people is being completely undermined in Afghanistan, subordinated to weapons and power. And that's certainly not the hallmark of a democracy. It's the hallmark of a client state run by an imperialist power. Ruled over by drug lords who have gotten their weapons and are being fueled by the imperialist power and who act with complete impunity. It's a country ruled by a puppet leader. This is not democracy.
I'm talking with Sonali Kolhatkar, who's the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. Within the activist community and in progressive media, quite often when talking about the invasion of Afghanistan in fall 2001, people will bring up the Unocal pipeline and say that was part of the real reason why we went in, and comments along those lines. When I was in Afghanistan in May 2004, basically what I was hearing from the few people that I asked about the Unocal pipeline was that they're very sure that it was being built, but they didn't really know anything else about it. Do you know anything about that project? Is that happening?
A lot of American activists attributed the U.S. interest in Afghanistan to pipeline issues, that, you know, the U.S. basically went to Afghanistan because we were interested in building a pipeline across Central Asia going through Afghanistan. And they made that assumption based on the fact that in the 90s, Unocal Corporation did indeed attempt to build a pipeline, did indeed negotiate with the Taliban government to have them get revenues from the pipeline going through their country. And at the last minute, for various reasons, among them probably the agitation of feminists in this country against the Taliban, that pipeline deal did not go through. Now, however, I think it is far too simplistic an answer that the U.S. went into Afghanistan for building an oil and gas pipeline, primarily because that oil and gas pipeline is not as lucrative as one might imagine. In the last few years, there have been pipeline deals that have taken place, but they UNOCAL has stayed as far away from that as possible because they know everybody's watching them. And also, Afghanistan has always been a country that the U.S. has not really cared about. It's always been sort of a pawn. It's always been a proxy, a battleground for proxy wars. After 9/11, I think the main reason why the U.S. went to Afghanistan was a combination of reasons, the most important of which was that they had to recover what I call imperial prestige, which is the biggest, most powerful, the richest, most powerful country in the world had been invaded, when I say invaded, I mean the terrorist attacks, had been attacked. Somebody had to be taught a lesson. Somebody had to send, somebody had to get a message. The world had to give the message that you don't mess with the most powerful nation on earth and get away with it. And what better country to attack than a defenseless country with a rogue regime that nobody would defend, that had already been demonized so much. And Afghanistan was a perfect target for the U.S. to recover imperial prestige, whether or not, it was even responsible for the attacks. And I think that's the main reason why we went there. Now, once there, of course, it was very convenient for the U.S. to set up military bases. And I think another main reason why the U.S. went to Afghanistan was that it could set up military bases in Central Asia, a part of the world that it had never before had military bases, a part of the world that's extremely important because it is in the backyard of Russia and China, two important superpowers, regional powers, and rival powers to the U.S. The U.S. has never had military bases in Russia and China's backyard. Today, it has permanent military bases. There has been talk of making the U.S. bases in Afghanistan permanent, as well as they have bases in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, some of these Central Asian countries. And now it has bases in an area where it's dangerously close to Iran. It has the air base in Afghanistan that's close to Iran, and if the U.S. were to ever launch a war against Iran, it could do so very conveniently from its bases in Central Asia. That's one main reason. Now, there have been pipeline deals that have been done because Central Asia is an extremely oil and gas-rich region, especially natural gas. And several countries, including Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, have huge oil and gas reserves. There have the U.S. just recently completed an oil pipeline deal that goes across Central Asia that is definitely going to be quite lucrative for it. But there are also a number of other competing pipelines. For example, Iran, which has a lot of oil, wants to have a pipeline going through India, and the U.S. is not very happy about that. China wants to have a pipeline. Russia already has a pipeline and wants to build another pipeline. So you have all these countries that are competing to have pipelines in the region, and the U.S., with its control of the puppet government in Kabul, is poised to try to control the central country in Afghanistan geographically, which is Afghanistan. I think it's a little more complex than, the U.S. went to Afghanistan for oil and gas pipelines. But I definitely think that once the Bush administration is in Afghanistan, it's certainly going to do everything it can to take advantage of Afghanistan. We know that the U.S. went to Iraq for oil. There's no doubt about that. But the U.S. is not even that interested in Afghanistan. It's, in fact, planning on turning over its military operations in Afghanistan to NATO. And in Iraq, the U.S. doesn't want NATO to play anything more than the role of training military staff. You can tell by where troops are as how important that country is. So the U.S. has been ramping down its military operations in Afghanistan, reducing its troops, allowing NATO to increase its troops in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the U.S. has been focusing much more on Iraq. And the current administration has many more direct ties to corporations that benefit directly from Iraq's oil than from Afghanistan's oil and gas pipelines. So I think it was an issue that had some bearing on why the U.S. actually went to Afghanistan, but I don't think it was the central driving force.
So at this point in Afghanistan's history, what is the Afghan Women's Mission and RAWA, what are the members of those organizations doing to try to change things in Afghanistan?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about what RAWA is doing and then maybe what Americans can do. RAWA is doing what they've always done, which is they put a huge emphasis on education. They really feel that once people are educated, they will have the ability, the power to take their country into their own hands. And they have a special educational policy which reads like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Their teaching policy is based on human values and internationalism and gender equality and ethnic and religious tolerance and environmentalism. It's a really progressive document that's available on their website at rawa.org. RAWA is doing everything they can. They have political efforts, which, for example, they publish a political magazine, and they are combined. You know, for them, you cannot have humanitarian and social projects without political action, and neither can you have political action without dealing with the humanitarian issues, because they're so great in Afghanistan. So they're doing this very successful combination of both political and humanitarian work, which has worked for them for so many decades. And what they need from us is they need solidarity, both moral and financial. Because of the lack of media coverage, donations have dropped enormously.
I mean, Afghan Women's Mission is primarily formed of Americans, men and women, who really were, you know, feel like we want to do solidarity work with RAWA.
We had huge numbers of donations after 9/11. We were able to help RAWA open many projects. Many of those projects have closed down right now. RAWA used to have 100 income generation projects in Kabul alone. Today they have about 30 because they've just been not being able to afford them because U.S. donations have dropped so low. So the least that people can do to help RAWA and their mission is to donate as much money as they can, especially if they're wealthy, if they can organize fundraisers or anything. They can become monthly pledge partners with us. Afghan Women's Mission is working very hard to encourage this sort of financial solidarity, because we really, you know, our whole goal is to let RAWA lead the way. We don't ever tell RAWA what to fund, how to fund it, which project to do. We allow them to be empowered and to figure out which project to do. They send us budgets and we send them the money. And we comply with all IRS rules and provide nonprofit status to the donations. But we really allow RAWA to take the lead. What we need in this country is, I think, we need for the anti-war movement to expand its sights beyond Iraq and into Afghanistan, and to really address the legitimacy of the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan, and to also make the connections between the real fears of the American people of terrorism and what's happening in Afghanistan. Because, like it or not, ultimately, when our government fuels fundamentalism in Afghanistan, it comes back to haunt us in the most brutal and ugly ways. And we certainly have to do that. So I really encourage listeners to, in their activism, include Afghanistan. You can go to our website and get a lot of information. I'm working on a book right now that covers U.S. policy in Afghanistan that I hope will be out next spring by Seven Stories Press, which I hope will be a tool for activists to educate themselves about what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan and to really move forward. And just support RAWA as much as you can. Solidarity work is so crucial for us in our movements. We really have to know what people are doing on the ground who are democratic, you know, minded, forward-thinking, progressive individuals, and how we can support their movements to help undo some of the damage that our government has done on them.
Do you have a title or a working title for your book?
Right now the title is Bleeding Afghanistan. It should be, it's being published by Seven Stories Press. It should be out next spring.
Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, thanks very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Do you mind if I give out a couple of websites?
Oh, please do.
If listeners want more information on how they, as Americans in particular, can help RAWA, I really encourage you to visit our website. It's AfghanWomen'sMission.org. That's AfghanWomen'sMission.org. And there you can find out how you can do financial solidarity with RAWA, how you can make donations, as well as how you can let others know about it. You can join our mailing list. You can become a monthly pledge partner. And especially go to RAWA's website directly, where you can read about their political activities, their social activities, RAWA's various political demonstrations and statements that they've released,
press coverage, etc., and that is rawa.org. That's rawa.org.
That was Tom Jackson talking with Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. She's also host of Uprising, a daily news program on Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles. That was Roro Keda by Zarsanga from Afghanistan. Now for a commentary by Steve Diamond.
And next we have a column I wrote for NH Indie Media. It's called Fake Wars Lost. The War on Terror is founded on our surrender in the War on Poverty and the War on Drugs, which promises a failed end to what we were told would be a permanent conflict. With the launch of the War on Terror, we can now declare both the War on Poverty and the War on Drugs fully lost, at least for the foreseeable future. This is because, in practice, Bush's strategy in the War on Terror is to form strong alliances with governments that are closely allied with major drug traffickers, or turn a blind eye to their activities. This occurs particularly in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Colombia. They join together to fight the poor of the world, including campesinos resisting corporate globalization, terrorist organizations resisting U.S. global domination, and poor people worldwide who have no way to earn a living without cultivating or smuggling drugs. U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan face particularly twisted ironies on a daily basis, along with the stress of living in extremely harsh conditions and the imminent threat of violent death. As you can see for yourself from archive.org in the film Taliban Country, U.S. soldiers are guided past fields of poppies by a warlord who calls himself the Minister of Agriculture. In the first segment of Taliban Country, one Marine even says, quote, "When we're done with the war on terrorism and start the war on drugs, you guys aren't going to be our friends anymore." Despite what that soldier might believe based on his experience, the war on drugs is supposedly continuing as we speak, epitomized in U.S. military aid to the Colombian government, which they used to fight leftist guerrillas in their ongoing civil war. In Afghanistan, despite, or perhaps because of, considering the power vacuum created by ousting the Taliban, a massive foreign invasion and occupation, drug production is booming, and the profits are booming as well. As the CIA knows from experience, illegal wars are best financed through illegal drug smuggling. And despite U.S. indignation about Al-Qaeda fighters and labeling them unlawful combatants for not following the rules of engagement we expect of them, they are also sustained by drug money. The U.S. empire has forgotten and long since lost the war on poverty, has indefinitely tabled and redefined out of existence the war on drugs, and therefore is waging the war on terrorism in an incredibly incompetent and short-sighted manner, which is particularly problematic when you start an endless war. Of course, it doesn't have to be this way. America could seriously address the underlying causes of poverty and reduce the resentment much of the world's people have at our decadent lifestyles. We could stop fighting leftist peasants and governments with secret wars and dry up the funding for terrorist organizations by legalizing drugs. Unfortunately, the vast power politicians wield begs to be abused. They have little interest in peace, freedom, and justice when fear can be sold at such great profit. Once again, that article can be found at nhindiemedia.org, along with extensive citations to mainstream media stories.
I come this morning through my pulpit to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This sermon is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia. Nor is it an attempt to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam of the National Liberation Front, paragons of virtue, nor to overlook the role they must play in a successful resolution of the problem. This morning, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi, the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans who bear the greatest responsibility and ended a conflict that has exacted a heavy price on both continents. Now, since I am a preacher by calling, I suppose it is not surprising that I have seven major reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hope, and new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam. I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. You may not know it, my friends. It is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society, sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor.
That was a recording of Martin Luther King mixed together with a Peter Gabriel song off benfrank.net. That piece is called War on the Poor.
Here's an article by author Tom Hartman entitled Time to Reconsider Jefferson's Call for Universal Service. Thomas Jefferson first suggested that we not have a standing army and wrote a series of letters in 1787 as the Constitution was being debated, urging James Madison and others to write it into the Constitution. The idea was, instead of a standing army, for every able-bodied man in the nation to be a member of a local militia under local control with a gun in his house. If the nation was invaded, word would come down to the local level and every man in the country would be the army. Switzerland has such an army, and many have suggested it's one reason why Hitler never tried to invade this neighbor. To facilitate this, it was suggested that three things were necessary: a ban on a standing army, a provision making every able-bodied male a trained member of a local militia that could come under national control if the nation was attacked, and a provision making sure every male had a weapon handy if that day ever came. Step one would be to write a ban on a standing army into the Constitution. When Jefferson received the first draft of the new Constitution in 1787, he wrote that without an addendum, a Bill of Rights, he would recommend that Virginia oppose it. In a February 12, 1788 letter, he noted to his friend Mr. Dumas, "With respect to the new government, 9 or 10 states will probably have accepted by the end of this month. The others may oppose it. Virginia, I think, will be of this number. Besides other objections of less moment, she will insist on annexing a Bill of Rights to the new Constitution, a bill wherein the government shall declare that, 1. Religion shall be free, 2. Printing presses free, 3. Trials by jury preserved in all cases, 4. No monopolies in commerce, and 5. No standing army." The topic was hotly debated, and Alexander Hamilton wrote an extensive article about it. The article is now known as Volume 29 of the Federalist Papers. He wrote, "If standing armies are dangerous to liberty, an efficacious power over the militia, in the body to whose care the protection of the state is committed, ought, as far as possible, to take away the inducement and the pretext to such unfriendly institutions." But while many founders saw a standing army as a threat to democracy, others pointed to threats ranging from hostile Indians to French Canadians and Spanish Floridians as reasons to keep it. The debates among the framers of the Constitution led to a clumsy compromise, with the ban on a standing army and universal requirement for membership in a militia chopped away, to be revisited at some, presumably near, future time. The tattered and compromised remnant of that discussion is today known as our Second Amendment to the Constitution, which reads in its entirety, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." As you can see, the Second Amendment thus had virtually nothing to do with the "we can rise up against an oppressive government" argument put forth by today's advocates of ownership of assault weapons, or the "right to self-defense in your own home" argument put forth by the NRA. As president, Jefferson again tried to revive his argument. He slashed the size of the army to just over 3,000 soldiers, closing forts and cutting costs. But he couldn't kill off the army altogether because the citizens' militia had never been formalized at a federal level. After he left office, Jefferson came to the conclusion that he couldn't get rid of the army, that every man should be a member of it, if only for a brief time. This would ensure diversity of opinions in the army and minimize the chances of a military coup or a military culture that could become so powerful it would influence the government or seduce the president into playing commander-in-chief too often in foreign adventures. Jefferson was also morally offended by the idea of an army that people would join only because they were so poor there was no other way to get an education and a job. For such people, he wanted universal free public education, including free college tuition, which he brought into being when he founded the University of Virginia. He noted that so-called voluntary armies depend on a pauper class for their existence. By the end of his presidency, in 1808, Jefferson had largely done away with America's standing army, and he was thus inspired to write to his friend Dr. Thomas Cooper, on September 10, 1814, that "our men are so happy at home that they will not hire themselves to be shot at for a shilling a day. Hence, we can have no standing armies for defense, because we have no paupers to furnish the materials." That was an excerpt from an article by Tom Hartman. For more information on his writings and his books, see www.TomHartmann.com.